The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Create, do, explore. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
We've been talking an awful lot about mental health recently and how it's okay not to be okay. That's a message that my next guest would like to talk about. 36-year-old Michael Finnegan grew up in Crumlin in Dublin, but soon found his mental health deteriorating over the years. And he joins me in the studio now to talk about the fact that there is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. Michael, good morning to you now. Is it Michael or Mick?
Mick.
Because it's Mick on Twitter.
It is, yeah.
It's Mick on Twitter. So, Mick, you're very welcome. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I mentioned there that you grew up in Crumlin, and not that it matters where you grew up, but I suppose your background is quite interesting because it gives us an idea of where your story starts. And your family situation, I suppose, how would you describe it when you were growing up?
I'd say it was quite difficult, you know. It wasn't kind of, I'd say, the run-of-the-mill, supportive, loving or caring family, you know. There was a lot of kind of criminality surrounding the family. There was quite a bit of drug use. I think like any person growing up in an inner city environment, I think someone would know someone who was, you know, maybe using drugs or struggling with addiction or mental health issues. So yeah, it wasn't the easiest start in life.
You ended up homeless at quite a young age.
I did, yeah.
How did that come about? Like, how did you end up on the streets?
I did. I ended up, sadly, sleeping rough. I was actually, I was abused as a child, and I made a complaint to the guards, you know, when I was old enough to kind of know that what was happening was wrong, and the guards investigated, and sadly, he wasn't prosecuted, and like my family just didn't, you know, they didn't believe me. No one believed me, and
which is something I suppose that we sadly have heard an awful lot about when it comes to that sort of
massive
behaviour and abuse.
Yeah.
You know that and what then? How did it manifest that you ended up leaving the family home and on the streets?
Just behaviour management issues, you know, because of the trauma that I experienced. I wasn't really kind of able to kind of maybe put into words how I was actually feeling. And I think, you know, I just got enough for them and I just got kicked out and I ended up sleeping rough. And
were you very young at this point? How old were you?
I was young enough.
You're 36 now. And
yeah.
Were you a teenager when you ended up on the streets?
Yeah, I was young enough, yeah. And, you know, it wasn't easy, you know, sleeping rough and, you know, not being able to access emergency accommodation and, you know, eventually getting, you know, to the point where you could access emergency accommodation and you're surrounded by grown men and people kind of, you know, actively, you know, shooting up in front of you. And and it was tough. But thankfully there was a couple of people that, you know, really kind of helped and supported me, you know what I mean? Howard Russell was the main catalyst for that. He was like the Salvation Army manager of the homeless hostel there in town there. And he was like the director or the assistant director of homeless services for the UK of Ireland now. But when he was younger, he was like a junior kind of Salvation Army officer. And he was just, you know, he didn't give up on me, you know, and he slowly over time became probably one of the most consistent people in my life. And with his support and kind of him giving me the opportunity to kind of work in homeless services in London and stuff like that, you know, I was managed to kind of, you know, escape that kind of vicious cycle of homelessness. And
it might be, I suppose it's, you mentioned the word escape there, which is interesting because, you know, you describe now your very early formative years, you know, when you were a teenager as well, when you were a younger child, you know, very tricky, difficult and impressionable years for all of us. You know, we all remember what it was like, but you were witness to all of this kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering, how did you manage not to go down the route of, say, drugs, for example? You know, you said there that people were shooting up in front of you, there was drugs around you. And you're
terrified of needles. That's the truth. I was just literally terrified of needles. Like, I would have drank maybe a little bit when I was on the streets, sometimes just to kind of get through the day. But overall, there were no kind of underlying kind of substance use issues.
That's incredible, because I'm also afraid of needles. I really am. I'm terrible. When it comes to blood tests or anything like that, I just can't do it.
Yeah, I hate them. Like, even in work, when I'm taking blood off patients and stuff like that, you know, I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing this now, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, when I was younger, like, I was, you know, because you were told, like, when we were growing up in, you know, in the flats or whatever, or going around, like, there was dirty needles everywhere. And this is, like, before there were, you know, outreach teams and, you know, needle exchange services and stuff like that. You know, you wouldn't be, you know, you'd have Elwyn's kind of throwing hot water and bleach down the stairs and the flats just to kind of, you know, keep people off them from, you know, using drugs in the area and stuff like that.
Trying to clean them to make sure that they weren't dirty, yeah.
Well, that as well, but just to stop people from hanging around and sitting on them, you know.
What happened, I suppose, then was you, like you say, you had the support and you managed to get yourself out of Dublin, which sounds like it was probably a good move for you. Or was it at the time? And where did you go when you left Dublin?
Yeah, I went to London. I got offered a job in London. I was working with the homeless over there, doing outreach work and stuff like that, and working in kind of a hostel. And initially, yeah, it was great. You know, because it was somewhere new, it was fresh. You know, anyone that's lived in London or has experienced London, yeah, it can be a bit of an unforgiving city if you don't know anybody. But overall, it's probably one of my favourite cities, you know, in the world. You know, it's so multicultural and ethnically diverse, and, you know, it's class, you know. I loved it initially, but, you know, over time, you know, because I didn't deal with the trauma from my childhood, you know, that started to creep up on me, to the point where, you know, I was struggling massively with my mental health, you know.
And the mental health then issues that you had, obviously, they came to a head. And it's interesting that you said you were working with the homeless and, you know, working in an area, I suppose, that you had already come through. So that must have been an interesting change for you, in a way, to go from being a homeless person in Dublin to then helping people in a different city who were in the same situation as you had been yourself.
Well, I worked in Dublin in homeless services before I moved to London, so it wasn't really that new to me. You know, I remember, I think Peter McFerry gave me my first job as a project worker. I went down and met with him, and he gave me a job in the old, you know, there was a support housing project on the Whitworth Road there, and, you know, that was my kind of first official kind of role in homeless services.
And did you like it? Did you like working?
Yeah, I liked helping people. Like, I just, I don't know what it is about. Like, I just genuinely like helping and supporting other people, and I was quite good at it and stuff like that. So, but yeah, no, I really, really, really enjoy it. Yeah.
So you're in London now, and you're enjoying working with people who need help. But like you say, you touched on it there a little while ago, that the mental health issues were creeping back. What happened?
Yeah, I just, you know, I ended up kind of having a bit of a, not a bit of a, bit, very big, very public mental breakdown in London, where I was, you know, just, I climbed the bridge back in 2009, and I got into a 4-hour standoff with the Metropolitan Police, convinced, you know, I wanted to, you know, I was convinced at the time that I wanted to die and everything that went along with that, struggling with my mental health and the trauma that I experienced as a child and even as a teenager, and then going on then being homeless after that. And then luckily the Met Police got in touch with Howard, who was in London at the time. And like, I've known Howard for a long, long time. He talked me down, and I was.
Did he come to where you were?
Yeah, the police actually turned up to his house, and we laugh about it now. You know, like, he jokes about kind of it was the best taxi service he's ever had in London, and they turned up to his house. They picked him up. They drove him over to the bridge where I was standing on, and, you know, there was probably at least 20 or 30 policemen there, you know, and negotiators and the whole thing. And it's one of the main kind of arteries into London, you know, and they wanted to kind of resolve that quite quickly. And, you know, I was just so manic and so unwell that I didn't really understand what was happening, you know.
But when you saw Howard turn up, did you feel a sense of relief?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, there was a sense of relief there. You know, Howard was, you know, nearest thing I'd have to, again, to family, really, you know, because he was just that consistent person. Like, we speak pretty much every week, you know, we'll be always on the phone chatting away to each other and slagging each other off.
So this is the same guy who initially helped you when you were younger, when you were on the streets in Dublin, homeless. And here he is now helping you again in London. After that, had you talked before about the abuse you'd suffered, and I suppose about your kind of chaotic,
Not really. I remember going to the Rape Crisis Centre for a couple of counselling sessions, and at the time I think you only got like two or three sessions free, and I was homeless, didn't have a pot that, you know, I had nothing. After that, I just kind of balled it up and kind of got on with it. But it still affected me because I wasn't really able to kind of, you know, at the time, you know, I wasn't really able to have a meaningful relationship with anybody because I didn't let anybody in. I didn't trust people enough. Always quite defensive a lot of the time in relation to kind of how I viewed relationships and stuff like that. So,
You end up obviously on the right side of the bridge that particular day.
Yeah, I got talked down, and then I got arrested.
Right, and then it went down a whole different. But look, I suppose this was it was a cry for help, presumably.
I wouldn't necessarily, only because I like to challenge the stigma that I associate with mental health, and I would never kind of use that language with anyone's suicide attempt, just purely because it kind of, like for me, I'm okay now talking about it because I went through quite an intensive kind of counselling process, and but I know a lot of people would probably be offended if they were, because they would think that, oh, well, I'm not being validated, or this is, you know, you're not taking me seriously.
A cry for help, in other words, isn't the term to use.
I would take any attempt quite seriously, to the point where, you know, there are, you know, and you see it in the coroner's court a lot of the time. You know, coroners will rule death by misadventure because I'm not 100% sure whether or not that person actually meant to complete suicide. So,
it's good to know, and I think it's good that we're constantly actually talking about terms and talking about language when it comes to mental health.
Absolutely,
because it's important, isn't it?
Yeah, and stigma is massive, and discrimination sadly still exists for people who suffer with, you know, even anxiety, depression, serious mental illness. You know, even in the workplace. You know, you can experience discrimination because employers, you know, they're like, oh God, how do we deal with this? You know, they're like very reluctant to kind of, you know, either employ people with mental health issues or support people with mental health issues. That's why they're always referred to occupational health, and they're like, well, actually, maybe it's not the right job for you or whatever, like that type of thing. And we should be supporting people more. And talking about it more openly.
It's changing though, isn't it? I mean, is it? I certainly feel like that we're talking about it more,
but I don't think the services exist within the country that we live in to kind of provide for people who are in crisis. You know, I don't even think there's a 24/7 CAMHS service. CAMHS is Child Adolescent Mental Health Services. You know, I think I saw something the other day on Twitter, someone was talking about that, and it's great that people like Brezzy and, you know, they're like out there and are challenging that stigma, and it's great to challenge the stigma, but I think sometimes talk's cheap. I think our politicians need to do more to provide, you know, a service that makes a real and lasting difference in the lives of, you know, people that are struggling.
I think your story, Mick, is fascinating because, you know, you were already, one would imagine, as a teenager sleeping on the streets in Dublin, rock bottom, and then you find yourself on a bridge in London, having kind of come through one, you know, bad period, to then you start working with homeless people, and you're obviously given a little bit back, and you end up at another rock bottom place. Thankfully, then after that, you end up finding a sport. which is a bit incredible. And there was an interesting journey to finding that sport, and that was rugby. Tell me about the rugby.
Yeah, so like nobody would touch me with a barge pole in regards to employment. Like everywhere I went for a job, you know, initially I'd get the job, but then on my criminal records check would come up and go, yeah, he was in a 4-hour standoff with the Met Police. He was, sectional of the Mental Health Act on this day, on that day, on that day. And at the time, before mental health got cool, nobody would touch you. No one would talk to you. No employers would go near you. I remember like kind of being struggling with kind of not being employed, and I was walking down the high street, and like, I was looking at, I think it was Will Greenwood and Scott Quinnell, the rugby legends. You know, Will won the World Cup with England, and Scott was a British and Irish Lion and captain of Wales rugby, and they were handing out leaflets about this TV programme called School of Hard Knocks. And they were like, come on, you know, like, come on. And I had no interest in rugby. I hadn't a clue. The only reference I knew about rugby was I knew all the D4 heads played it. And that was like literally, you know, I was growing up, you know, in the inner city, rugby was for posh people. And, you know, we played, you know, 5-a-side on an AstroTurf. And that was the only sport we really kind of got into.
And School of Hard Knocks was a reality TV show.
Yeah, on Sky Sports, yeah. It was mad. It was a 12 or 16-week programme.
So you got onto it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, they were teaching us how to play rugby. We had a physical training instructor called, and rugby coach called Chris Chudley. He was a former British Army captain.
Tough guy.
Yeah, an absolute lunatic. Like, he was shouting at you, he'd make you leper crawl across the pitch.
Were you sporty at all before? I mean, you said the 5-a-side or whatever on an AstroTurf.
Yeah, when I was growing up in Crumlin, I played for... I played in goal for Crumlin Rovers, but that was only because I was too fat to play anywhere else. Do you know what I mean?
So you have a good build for the rugby, in fairness.
I think rugby caters for the fuller figure male. whereas I think, you know, soccer, sadly, doesn't, you know what I mean?
And you're still playing rugby now?
Still playing, yeah, love it. It's a great sport.
And not just playing it, but actually involved in a charity that is kind of, it's about mental health, and you use the rugby, I suppose, to kind of get involved in that.
Yeah, well, I noticed there was a charity in Rugby League, which is completely different to Rugby Union, called State of Mind Rugby League, and I was like, I'm going to get in touch with them and see if I can adopt their model and set up State of Mind Rugby Union. And I contacted Dr. Phil Cooper, and they said, Phil, what's any chance we can meet up? And we met in King's Cross Station in London, and we had a...
And State of Mind charity is about mental health awareness.
Yes, it exists to improve the quality of life and mental health of rugby players, their families and the community. So we go in and we deliver a mental fitness session. We did a talk up in Queen's University, Belfast there with, you know, GAA legend Conor Mortimer. He's one of our ambassadors, Nigel Owens. He's our lead ambassador, you know, and it was great, you know, to see so many professionals and, you know, wanting to get involved and to try and help, you know, spread the message, you know, that it's okay not to be okay, and that if you do
and
need help.
And especially for big fellas, big men, you know, big strong men.
Well, men traditionally don't talk about their feelings, do they? Like, if we turned up to the pub and you go, hey, Aranto, listen, I'm feeling a bit down, he'd be like, what about that? Here, I'll get a point into you. And that's like traditionally kind of like, you know, we kind of water off a duck's back, kind of, we don't really deal with it, and we don't talk about it, and we don't really kind of reach out and ask for help when we're struggling. And we challenge that stigma, you know what I mean?
But that's not your full-time job, actually. I mean, you're actually working for the NHS at the moment, up in Belfast.
Yeah.
You've been there for a couple of years.
And I work in,
Just outside Belfast.
I work as a mental health... I work in mental health peer support, so I get to use my lived experience of accessing mental health services and being detained under the Mental Health Act in London and stuff like that to kind of encourage patients to access services. So there's an evidence-based approach for peer support, and it's very well received by patients or people who are in crisis, because they do respond very well to that. And I'm just lucky that I get to, again, make a little bit of a difference, you know, in getting and encouraging people to kind of, you know, engage with the service, maintain their medication, talk about how they feel, you know, because it's massive, you know.
Is it hard? Is it hard to see people who are in a bad place and to try and get them a bit of support and a bit of help?
No, I don't find it. I don't find it. You know, I think for me, because I've been working in health and social care for, you know, since I was like 19 or 20. I'm passionate about this stuff. You know, I do want to make a difference, and I do want to kind of provide the support. And if I can't provide the support, I'll signpost someone and say, look, I can't help you, but this lad can. You know, and it's good to kind of access those services and patients and people that I work with, they're really receptive to that, you know, they really take it on board.
We forgot to mention as well, in between everything that you've been doing, you went back to college and, well, you went to college.
Yeah, I've done a few little bits. Yeah. Like, nothing major. Like, I'm hoping to go to Trinity College this year. I got a place through their TAP programme.
So, what are you going to be studying there?
Well, hopefully after the year, social work. That's the plan. So I'll do a year foundation and then I'll go on and do a social work degree.
So you want to be a social worker?
Yeah, I want to specifically work in mental health. Yeah.
Well, I suppose the fact that you've got so much experience already working with people who are in need, surely, yeah.
But I need that bit of paper to kind of reinforce my knowledge, skills and practice.
Of course you do. Mick, you speak so eloquently and clearly about this area, considering, I suppose, the background that you had yourself and the issues that you've gone through. Where are you now? I mean, how are you now yourself in your own head?
Yeah, no, I'm good. Like, I think it's a testament to the NHS, you know, for me to kind of go from, you know, being quite manic and quite unwell, you know, to trying to kind of end my life on several occasions and going missing in London and everything else that went along with that, to, you know, getting a diagnosis and getting the medication to kind of to give me that stability is massive. You know, for me, it's massive. And, you know, I'll always be very, very thankful for the service that the NHS in London provided for me, because without them, I wouldn't have found that stability. You know what I mean? Rugby was, you know, a part of it. But then, you know, that was only a small bit. Like, the other bit was, like, the trauma, dealing with that. And then, you know, and then going on and then taking me meds. I used to duck hospitals and I used to abscond and I wouldn't engage with services. Because I was like, I'm grand, don't need any help. And then I'd just be completely manic and I'd be completely unwell. And, you know, I'd relapse in my mental health. And then eventually I got diagnosed with bipolar. And with that diagnosis came a medication regime. And thankfully, it's given me a stability now, where it's 5 years I've not been, you know, admitted to hospital or, you know, for my mental health. Now, obviously, I've been admitted for other things like physical stuff, being injured and playing rugby. But from a mental health perspective, you know, it's massive, you know.
That's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
I can sense that. I can sense that for you. That's important for you. Is it almost like kind of the way, I don't know, the way alcoholics might say, I'm so many years sober. Do you feel like that the 5 years is important for you as a kind of a, just that you feel kind of clear?
Well, see, I have a plan in place called a WRAP plan. It's an approach to kind of maintaining your wellness and recovery. And it stands for Wellness Recovery Action Plan. And that for me helps me maintain my own stability. So if I'm having a bad day, or if I'm not feeling up for it, you know, I have, you know, supporters I can ring, I can contact my GP, or I can, you know, get referred to the psychiatrist, or if I need a bit of counselling and stuff like that. So, you know, there's an onus and a responsibility for me to maintain my recovery. Like, if I did nothing, I'd get nothing, you know what I mean? But it's important for me to kind of continue to do that, you know.
Well done to the you thanked the NHS, and good on the NHS for having you. But I think we need you back here, Mick. Now I think we need you back here. So yeah, get into Trinity now, and I think we need you to start implementing your incredible hard work here. Do you go back to Crumlin?
The odd time, yeah, I do. I go back and I see some of the lads I went to school with, and I'd hang about with them like for an hour or two and see how they're getting on. They're all doing very well, so it's good, like, you know.
Thanks so much, Mick, for coming in. Great speaking to you, and great to hear your story, Mick Finnegan. And look, if you've been affected by any of the issues we've been discussing with Mick today, there's lots of help available. I'll just give you some of the numbers and names. The Samaritans, you can telephone them 116 123. Aware as well are available. They've both got websites. Aware, 1800 80 48 48. And of course, Pieta House as well, 1800 247 247 or pieta.ie.